What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today we have a Q&A episode, so thank you to everybody who asked a question. We're going to get through as many as we can in at least 37 minutes here. Let's jump in. First question, should you limit the amount of fiber you eat pre-workout since it digests slowly? Yeah, if your pre-workout meal is very close to your training. Here's how you maximize pre-workout nutrition for basic strength and hypertrophy outcomes. Don't be super stuffed while you train, and don't be super hungry while you train. Right? So eat a meal that you have time to digest well before you train, and don't show up to your session super mega hungry. That's what I want you to think about. So yes, things like fat and fiber can slow down digestion. Having more calories also means it'll take longer to digest. So if you are eating 2 hours before you train, then you should have a totally balanced meal, right? Protein, carbs, fats, fiber, the whole gang. If you're eating 30 minutes before you train, then yeah, you're going to want to pick things that digest more quickly. So I would rather people think about what's most convenient in their schedule. When is it convenient for me to make a meal before I train, and then optimize their, you know, the composition of that meal in relation to the amount of time they have to train. If you're someone who rolls right out of bed and you want to eat something before you train because you feel quite hungry in the morning, then yeah, you don't have much time. You might be even eating while you train. So you're going to want things that digest more quickly, absorb more quickly, you know, higher glycemic carbohydrates, protein, et cetera. Maybe not a ton of fat and fiber, but you might be somebody who eats, I eat at 7 o'clock. I lift at 9 o'clock. My 7 o'clock meal is a totally normal balanced meal. I'm not thinking, oh, it's going to have too much fiber. Oh, it's going to have too much fat. I'm thinking about just generally what I want from a meal in terms of meal composition, knowing that 2 hours later, I'm going to be feeling pretty well digested, not super hungry and not super stuffed. So I hope that gives you a little bit more context. Next question. You mentioned incorporating more plant proteins in a podcast. Is the protein in beans just as beneficial as the protein in chicken? So protein is just a composition of amino acids. So when we say the protein in beans, what we're talking about is the amino acid composition of the protein in beans versus the amino acid composition of the protein in chicken. Without going too nerdy into this, the benefit that we see in the literature, what we see in the literature is when people swap out animal protein for plant protein, there's an improvement in cardiovascular health outcomes, let's say. And I would say that it's not because the amino acids in beans are better in some way. I'd say because very generally that sort of a swap represents very likely a reduction in saturated fat from animal proteins, things like red meat, processed meat, and an increase in plant fiber, right? So that swap isn't necessarily because the amino acids in things like beans or tofu or lentils are any better. Amino acids are just amino acids. Animals are a really great source of amino acids. So it's not like the amino acids are better in plants. It's that that swap represents a shift in dietary pattern that most likely leads to less saturated fat from animal foods and more dietary fiber. And that swap is going to lead to improvements in a whole host of things, but specifically cardiovascular health. Next question. On the subject of plant proteins, do you have to have a higher protein goal if you're getting a good bit of protein from plants? The answer is technically yes, but not in the context of the numbers you're probably thinking about. So if you are eating, let's say 1.6 grams per kilogram, so it's like 0.77 grams per pound, if you get that from plants, entirely from plants or entirely from animal foods, you're going to be fine because that is so much protein that you're getting enough of the amino acids and you're good. But if somebody, the less protein you eat, the more you might have to pay attention to where you're getting that protein from. And the less protein you eat as a vegan, the more you have to think about where that protein is coming from. So let me put it more simply. If you're an omnivore and you at least eat some animal proteins, then you almost never need to think about this. You don't need to have a higher protein goal. You don't need to think about, oh, I'm getting some from like complete sources, some from incomplete. If you're an omnivore, just think about eating enough total protein. If you're a vegan, I still think, and it's not just my opinion, we have research on this, if you eat enough total protein, 1.6 grams per kilogram, 0.77 grams per pound, stuff, you know, even lower, 1.2 to 1.4 grams per kilogram, we see amazing health and muscle outcomes in people who eat, you know, primarily, if not solely, plant protein. So If you are already eating enough protein, you don't need to make it go any higher. But if you are somebody on the lower end, you're in this, like, let's say 1 to 1.4 grams per kilogram, that's like maybe 0.5 to 0.65 grams per pound, and you go completely vegan, then I would at least consider, hey, maybe we want to get more total protein to account for the fact that some of these proteins are lower in some amino acids. So the answer is technically yes, but only to a point. Once you're getting, I would say, 1.6 grams per kg, if you're getting your protein from a variety of plant foods, you're good. And if you're an omnivore, I wouldn't worry about it at all. You said if you're getting a good bit of protein from plants, which makes me think you are an omnivore because you didn't say only from plants. So in this case, I would not adjust your protein target. I would keep it at, you know, roughly 1.6 grams per kg if you're looking to build, you know, near maximum, if not maximum muscle. But if you are already eating a lower protein diet and you go from being an omnivore to a vegan, then I would just double click on that and say, hey, either we need to be more intentional with which plant protein sources we're eating, or we need to increase the total amount so that becomes less of an issue. Next question. For cardio, I have trouble with walking due to ankle issues, but I'm able to bike and box on soft mats. Oh, awesome. If I bike for 30 minutes three times a week and box for 3 hours a week, is that enough cardio to make up for the recommended 7.5 to 10,000 steps? It's hard to say. There's no like simple algorithm of like, oh, you know, plug this into some formula. If you're doing, let's say, boxing for 1 hour a week and 90 minutes of biking, so that's 3 hours of, we'll call it cardio, plus 90 minutes. So that's 4.5 hours of cardio. That to me signifies an incredibly robust stimulus. Like I think you can be in incredible cardiovascular shape doing this. Do I think it makes up for the steps? I'd say if not definitely yes, mostly yes. I think there's probably a small benefit to getting up and moving throughout the day. Right, you know, just breaking up the day with some walking, and when we think about step counts, that's something that we tend to recommend. It's like, hey, let's see if we can get these steps kind of throughout the day. Of course, doing concise cardio counts towards your steps. Of course, just in case anybody's saying that, you know, doing cardio is awesome, absolutely counts towards your steps. I think of you where you're like, hey, maybe I'm not walking around throughout the day, but I am getting 4.5 hours of cardio per week. I think that there's, you know, you're doing an unbelievable job, and I would not be sweating the fact that you're not able to get up and move throughout the day. Honestly, I think what would be left for you is potentially considering getting in some movement throughout the day for mental health, just for, you know, so you're not sitting for 8 hours a day at your job, but you're up and moving around a little bit. But that wouldn't be from like a cardiovascular health perspective. I would come more at it from a mental health perspective. Next question. What do you think makes a good coach? Oof. I think, you have to have the knowledge. You have to have two things. You have to have the vast majority of the knowledge that your clients need, like questions that they have. You don't need to know every single thing in the universe, because the other part of that is being willing to admit when you don't know and being willing to go out and explore and learn, right? I don't think I have every single answer that my clients have ever asked me, like logged in my brain somewhere, but I'm, you know, I've at least enough of a foundational knowledge that I'm able to field those questions and communicate them effectively. And then the rest of that stuff, I'm willing to go figure out. I'm not an expert in absolutely everything. I know where my blind spots are, where my weak points are, and I'm willing to learn more or outsource when necessary. The second thing I think is, it's just some amount of EQ, right? It's just some, you know, you need the knowledge because you need to be able to talk the nuts and bolts, the science, the physiology of things, but that's not enough, right? You're not dealing with a computer, you're dealing with a person. Even if you're dealing with a computer in the sense of an online coach, you're still dealing with a person. So some level of EQ, some, you know, if somebody asked me what's the most important book to read as a coach, it's not a physiology book. It's not a programming book. It's not a nutrition book. It's motivational interviewing. And motivational interviewing is a book I think every counselor or coach should read. It just, don't even want to give away the game here, but it's a book that helps you shape conversations in a way that leads people to making the type of behavior change that lasts. And that's really what you're doing as a coach, is trying to help people make long-lasting behavior changes. And the best way to do that is to empower people to empower them with feelings of autonomy, that they are the ones making the changes, that they're in charge, that they've done this themselves, to kind of get out of your writing reflex of just telling everyone exactly what to do, which can feel like what you should do in the moment, but we know that people are more likely to make and sustain behavior change when they feel like they have some amount of control and say in the matter. Next question. Over a year in your group, my upper body is outpacing my lower to me. I'm guessing you mean in growth. Really love the group, but wondering if I need to do more of a lower specialization while maintaining upper to see what I've been hoping / dreaming. At what point am I asking too much from group programming? I think it's a good question. I think that there's, is my group program the absolute best program possible for every single person in there? No, I mean that, of course not. There is no such thing as a group thing that is best for every single individual. What I would say is I'm not sure that that would be the answer. I'm not sure that doing more volume for your lower body would be the answer. It might be. And you could, in theory, modify the group and just, you know, in theory, take away some sets from upper body, add a couple of sets to lower body. And that essentially would be a lower specialization cycle. If you just maybe added a set to a couple things of lower body, lowered a set to a couple things of upper body. It could also be you fighting your genetics of, hey, this is where I'm genetically, this is where I'm more predisposed to build muscle more quickly, more easily. But I think that it's totally fair for somebody to say, hey, at some point I have a very specific goal, and an individual person's very specific goal is not where I'm coming from programming for the group. So totally understand that, by the way. If you were like, hey, like I'm a bodybuilder, let's say, and I really need to grow this muscle. It's like, well, I haven't taken that into account when I'm programming this, of course. So, you know, you say, at what point am I asking too much from group programming? I, as much as I want to keep people in the group, and as much as I love the group growing and all of that, you could explore a specialization cycle for X amount of months and see, hey, do I like this? Did it give me kind of what I was looking for? But I also think you could modify the group program and say, hey, I'd say right now our group program is a pretty even split from upper and lower. This is a group made for people who want to build kind of everything. It does tip in the direction of more women centric, meaning we do a little bit less pec development, than the typical, again, I don't want to overly generalize from a sex perspective, but very generally speaking, if you are a guy and you join my group, the one thing I would tell you is maybe add an extra pec exercise each cycle. But yeah, at some point, I think if you wanted to work more lower than upper, you could modify the group. You could add some lower volume. You could decrease some upper volume, and you could do that pretty easily. A couple extra sets of lower, a couple less sets of upper, and you could redistribute your kind of weekly total stress and recoverability to more appropriately reflect in a proportionate sense what you care about. So I think you could absolutely do that. Next question. Does it matter how you schedule your training days? For example, if I lift Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and do some cardio the other days, is that fine as long as I'm recovering well? So there's two separate questions. Does it matter, and is that fine? The first question, does it matter? Yes. Second question, is that fine? Yes. It's absolutely fine. The challenging part of this schedule is that Monday and Wednesday are both lower body. And you might recover, you know, pretty well from Monday to Wednesday, right? You train legs heavy on Monday. You know, you're the rest of that day, you're pretty beat up. On Tuesday, you either have some DOMS or at the very least, your muscles are still recovering from the training on Monday. And by Wednesday, you're either fully recovered or nearly fully recovered. And I think you could survive it. In a perfect world, I would have you move that Wednesday workout to Thursday just to make absolutely sure that your legs are ready to rock. But if someone's like, hey, this is the only schedule I can do, I think you're going to be absolutely fine if you're recovering well. And the way you know you're recovering well is that very generally you're able to progress on things over the course of several weeks. Not necessarily just on a one-off, but you're like, hey, I'm progressing pretty well from month to month. It's like, okay, well, then this schedule seems to be something that you're recovering well enough from. And I would suspect that you would be just fine. Now, I tend to get more sore and kind of fucked up from lower body training. If this was the schedule I had to have, I would do upper on Monday and Wednesday. I find that even though the same principles apply, my lower body just gets more sore on average, and I would I'd be more annoyed training legs with sore legs than training upper with a little bit of residual soreness or fatigue. So I might flip-flop upper and lower. We tend to train lower body first Monday and Thursday. But if this was your schedule, you could consider doing upper body Monday, Tuesday lower, Wednesday upper, and then Friday lower again. And I think that that Tuesday to Friday would be really nice for your legs. But at the end of the day, I do think this will work just fine. Next question. Do you plan on doing group nutrition coaching? It seems like that's what everyone is doing right now. Yeah, that is what everybody is doing right now. And I have strongly considered it. I've even outlined what it would look like. And generally, it is my plan to do that. I moved my group community to Mighty Networks. And I will tell you right now, I'm staring at it right now on my screen. Mighty Networks is so awesome. I love it. It has so much potential for courses and lectures and communities and additional content. The fact that I am on Mighty Networks has made me feel, hey, dude, you got to do group nutrition coaching because you're already set up on the platform to do so. And I think I would do it well, whatever. I just have confidence I would do it well. However, this year is so crazy so far. We're house hunting right now. If that goes through, we're going to be moving in the next few months, moving into a new house, most likely back home in New Jersey. I'm feeling like the task of putting together all of the content to make this go live is something that is either going to happen in this winter or it's going to happen in early 2026. But I do think that group nutrition coaching is coming. I already have my group program. We're already set up on Mighty Networks. It would be, you know, potentially a small additional fee for people that are in the group, in my training group. And then obviously, if you just want to be in the nutrition group, it'll be a little bit more expensive, but I still want to keep it very cost effective. This is not something that I would have at a very high price point. I have seen some price points out there for group coaching that's not my style. And so it would be, you know, if my group program is $34, it would not be any more expensive than that. To be in both groups, yes, it would be more expensive than that. But for a single group, I think that that's most likely my limit. Next question. How is house hunting going? Wishing you the best. House hunting is the single most stressful activity that I've ever engaged in my entire life. Most likely, you know, for several reasons. Number one is stock market is crazy, and this is an insane market to be buying a house. We're looking at houses that 3, 4, 5 years ago were 50% of what they are now. And so that's been a dagger to my heart. It's like, hey, if we just bought a house 5 years ago, we could buy twice as nice of a house, let's say. So it kind of blows. And then the other thing is that we're buying a home back in New Jersey, most likely. That's what we're trying to do, at least. And we live in North Carolina, so we're never going to be, you know, we aren't able to just fly home and see these houses. So we're probably going to buy a house that we've never even seen or set foot in. Obviously, we FaceTime with people, our parents go see it. But like with a new baby, we're not just like hopping on a plane every 2 seconds. So it's been challenging. To be honest, though, every time I complain about it, it does feel a little first world problem-y. Like even though it does suck and it is a real problem, and 5 years ago it would have been way easier, I do still feel very blessed. I don't want to get caught up in kicking and screaming about a situation that I have no control over. We want to buy a house. We want to move on with our life. We want to move, you know, back home, closer to family, continue growing our family. And so it is what it is. We move on pretty quickly from the kicking and screaming phase. Although, whatever. There are some frustrations. Next question. What is the ideal rep range for hypertrophy? We'll keep it short and sweet. Rep range is more or less arbitrary. Muscles grow when you take a set close to failure, because when you get close to failure, you activate or you stress your high threshold motor units, those big, strong motor units, the ones that really grow. So what you need to do for hypertrophy is enough sets close to failure. Now, if you do a set close to failure with 15 reps or a set close to failure for 5 reps, the outcome is largely the same. So that has led people, we've looked at this in research and we see that anywhere from 5 to 30 reps has led to equivalent hypertrophy. Now, I don't really love that statement anymore because I think there's enough difference between a set of 5 and a set of 30 that I don't want to just throw my hands up in the air and say, it doesn't matter at all, just get close to failure. I would recommend the vast majority of your training be in the 5 to 12 rep range. Now, why do I recommend that? Even though I just said it doesn't matter, you just need to get close to failure. For starters, it takes less time. A set of 25 is going to take you much longer than a set of 6. And if they have the same outcome, well, why am I doing, you know, quadruple the reps, very long set? The second reason is with heavier weight and lower reps, people are better at assessing proximity to failure. If I give you a set of 25 reps and I tell you to go 2 RIR, or I give you a set of, you know, a much heavier set in the 6 to 8 rep range and I tell you to go to 2 RIR, people are a lot better at assessing failure or proximity to failure with heavier weight. And there's several reasons for that. I think with really high reps, people end up quitting their set because it burns, because it hurts, not actually because they got to the point of near muscular failure. If you've ever done high rep work, you know that it hurts. Like, it's local pain. You feel the burn. And that burn is often why people stop the set, when in reality, they didn't actually get as close to failure as they thought. They just reached a point of, you know, maximum tolerable pain, and they quit, right? And by the way, that's understandable. This shit hurts when you do high rep work. But when you do sets of like 5 to 10, maybe 5 to 12, you don't get as intense of a burn, so you're more able to get close to failure without that being something that forces you to, let's say, preemptively end the set. So when it comes to hypertrophy, physiologically, I think most rep ranges between 5 and 30 can all really work. But practically, you're going to be better at assessing proximity to failure. It's going to take less time. You're not going to kind of bitch out because of some sort of burn feeling if you're using heavier weights for lower reps in that 5 to 12 rep range. And I think within that 5 to 12, you know, maybe 5 to 15, I don't really love north of 12 for my training personally, but you might have some preferences for different exercises. What's a good example off the top of my head? Off the top of my head, I quite like cable lateral raises in the 8 to 12 rep range. I don't really love doing sets of 5, 6, 7, although you absolutely can do that. I think people think you can't do that. You can do a 5RM lateral raise, no problem, no downside. I personally don't love it. Doesn't feel as good on my joints. When it comes to my hack sled, I really like doing sets of 5 and 6. Something just feels right that I only have to kind of lock in for 5 or 6 reps. When I'm doing my hack squat for a set of 10, it's a little bit more cardiovascularly demanding, and I'm kind of just going through the motions for the first 5 reps, because the first 5 reps of a 10 rep set are going to be pretty easy. When I know I'm only doing 5 or 6, I know everyone is going to be hard. I can lock in. And so I really do like that. So you might find yourself having different preferences for different exercises. Next question, debunk this myth. You can eat too much protein in one sitting. Some meals I get 50, yet some people say don't eat more than 30 at a time. So this myth is completely and utterly debunked. Couple of things. At a single meal, there's probably an amount of protein that maximizes what's called muscle protein synthesis. So another way of saying that is there's probably a limit to how much protein your body can use towards building muscle. So it's not that you can't absorb, you know, more than X grams of protein at a meal, but there's probably an amount where after, if you eat more than that, you don't get any additional muscle building benefit from that meal. There's just, And that in theory, that is how that works, right? There's only, you know, let's say you eat 50 grams of protein and that maximizes what's called muscle protein synthesis, which is just like the muscle building benefit of that meal. And then if you eat 60, you don't see any extra muscle protein synthesis. If you eat 70, you don't see any extra. The problem is that number keeps going up and up and up and up and up. And it goes up so high that it practically doesn't matter as long as you eat enough total protein and you do it over at least 2 meals, right? We used to think that it was like 0.4 grams per kilogram of body weight. What am I? I don't know, 80 kilograms, 0.4. Oh no, I shouldn't have done this. It's like 32, right? So it's like, oh, I'm a 32 grams of a complete protein source with 2 grams of leucine. That's going to be the max amount of MPS. And if you eat more than that, you're wasting it. But then we saw that 50 grams of protein did better, and then 70 grams of protein did better, and 100 grams of protein did better. And there's probably a diminishing return, but what ultimately ends up mattering is eating enough total protein throughout the day, and I'd say doing that across at least 2 meals, maybe 3 to be safe. So first of all, 50 is not even remotely close to the upper end of what your body can use for building muscle at a single meal. If you want to have a discussion about what we've seen, I don't have the studies in front of me, but the amount of protein you'd have to eat to get to a point where you're no longer using it for productive protein synthesis, it's higher than you're doing. It's not a realistic number that people are actually dealing with. The only people who might be seeing a downside because of this is people who are eating one meal per day and they're eating all of their protein at that meal. If you eat at least 0.7 grams per pound of protein, you spread that over at least two, if not three meals, you're good to go. Next question. What is the actual mechanism that creatine uses for increasing muscle size? The cells are growing just because of increased water. Yes. Why isn't this a very temporary effect? Yeah, super, super simple. So creatine is what's called an osmolyte. It brings water with it into the cell. And if you're taking creatine on a consistent basis, then you have what's called a full creatine saturation. So your muscle cells are full of creatine because you are taking it in perpetuity. And so that is how creatine, let's say you said increases muscle size. That's more of just a visual thing because it's bringing water into the muscle cell. For those of you guys that don't know, creatine can lead to some water retention because of what I just said. It's an osmolyte. It brings water with it wherever it goes, and it's going in your muscle cell. However, this water weight is water weight that makes you look better. It is not the kind of water weight that you can like pinch with your finger. You're like, oh, I'm so bloated. That's not creatine. Creatine, you cannot pinch creatine's effects, right? It is putting water inside your muscle cell such that your muscles actually look more full. Full is a good word. Full means, you know, more muscular. The muscles look bigger. And so that is the reason that it increases muscle size. I don't think it is a game breaker, though. I don't want people to think, oh, I'm going to take creatine, all of a sudden I'm going to look way more jacked. I think that it will most likely do nothing that you can see with the naked eye, but that is what's happening kind of underneath the hood, let's say. You said the cells are growing just because of increased water. Yes. Why isn't this a very temporary effect? Because you are maintaining full saturation of creatine. I mean, it would be temporary when you stop, right? It's transient in the sense that it will only remain that way for the time that you're taking creatine. So if you start taking creatine 5 grams a day, after about a month, you will have full creatine stores and you will have gained whatever water weight that you were going to gain. And then again, if you stop for about 28 days, you will go back to whatever your baseline was. So it's temporary if you taking creatine is temporary. It is permanent for the length of time you're taking creatine. Next question. Recently added single arm curls into my routine and realized my right arm is much stronger than my left. Should I still train both arms to failure? Yes. Or do the same on each arm? Maybe. If you're in my group program, in our community, in the resources tab, you can scroll down. We have a bunch of training lectures. There is one lecture called Muscle Imbalances. What are they and how to fix them? I highly recommend you watch that lecture. Here's the deal. There's no perfect answer to this. Here's like the elevator pitch answer. If they're like one or two reps away from each other, let's say your right arm can do 10, but the left arm can do like 8 or 9, then I typically just say, hey, train the weaker one first, match with the stronger one, move on with your life. They're both going to be close enough to failure that you'll make progress. But if they're like 3 or 4 reps different, then I tend to recommend people split them up, train and track them differently. And so if you're like, my right arm can do 10 and my left arm can do 6, it's like, well, don't do 6 on both then. I'd rather you do 6 on one, 10 on the other, and progress them both individually. There are other examples of strategies in that lecture, one of them being, hey, you can kind of partial rep match. So you could do 10 reps on your right arm and then 6 full reps and 4 partial reps to get your, you know, get your kind of diagnostics back to 10 reps. Or you could do myo rep match. So on that weaker side, you could do a set of 6, rest 5 to 15 seconds, do another couple reps, rest 5 to 15 seconds, do another couple reps, and get yourself to 10 that way. So you can at least, you know, from a tracking perspective, say, okay, I'm doing 10 on each arm, but on my weaker arm, I'm going to use a strategy like myo rep match or partial rep match to get myself back to 10. I got a few more here. Next question. Does your GLP-1 podcast episode cover the possibility of using these meds to help knock off the last few pounds of body fat? Yes. Not sure if that's a thing or okay. I go over it in the podcast for sure, would be done in the context of ongoing consistent training, good nutrition, and overall solid habits that have now been in place for years. Yeah, my podcast absolutely goes into this context. This is not, the drug is not indicated for this purpose. There's a couple things going on. The first is all drugs have potential risks. The point of a drug is to have more reward than risk, right? You know, I don't mean to get on a touchy subject like vaccines, but the point of a vaccine is to be a net positive. The point of drugs in general are to be a net positive. There are no drugs that have no side effects. There are no compounds, supplements that have no risks attached. So if you're somebody who is trying to lose the last few pounds, I'm guessing there's a high likelihood that you wouldn't get any healthier losing those last few pounds. It is not the case that being incredibly shredded is the most healthy way to go through life. We see actually on average on a population scale, you know, the healthiest women are roughly 30% body fat. The healthiest men are roughly 20% body fat. That's not shredded. And so if you're looking to go from potentially that healthy body weight to, you know, more lean because you're trying to lose the last few pounds, again, I'm taking some assumptions here. My assumption is that that's not an intervention that's going to make you healthier. So what you're doing is you're taking a drug that has risk, but you're not getting the upside. The upside is when people take these things for diabetes or for obesity, that it will help them with their blood sugar control and help them lose weight, which for that person in that context has a high likelihood of improving their health. So you're taking a drug that you're not getting the upside, but you are by definition incurring some risk. I can't recommend that. I wouldn't recommend there's a person in my life that I love that should do that. Do I think the risks are so great that it's like some crazy risky thing you're doing? Probably not. But I think from an intellectual perspective, it's not a good risk to reward ratio because you're not getting any reward basically. Additionally, you only get the benefits of the drug while you're on the drug. And ironically, you've added this piece of context here where you've said, I already have consistent training, good nutrition, and overall solid habits in place. So if you start taking this drug, you will lose, you know, most likely the weight you want to lose. But then what? If you go back to what you were doing before without the drug, you know, we see that most people gain that weight back. So the type of person who is going to lose some weight and maintain most of that weight without the drug is the kind of person who, by using the drug, was able to improve their lifestyle habits such that when they remove the drug, they are left with improved lifestyle habits that are going to help them maintain as much weight loss as possible. But you're already somebody who's doing all that stuff really well. So you're going to take the drug, lose weight, remove the drug, and be in a similar position to you are right now. And by all accounts, I would bet you gain that weight back. So that is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is because you don't really need this drug for what it's indicated for, you are contributing to an environment where it makes it harder for people who need the drug to get it, you know, in some ways taking it from others. That is a more complicated discussion that I talked about on another podcast with Dr. Spencer Nadolsky, which is a very recent podcast. If you want to scroll back, it's within the last 5 episodes. I have a solo episode on GLP-1s, which I think candidly is an incredible resource if you want to learn about these drugs. And then a follow-up episode with Dr. Spencer Nadolsky, which goes over some stuff like this. So I highly recommend listening to both. Next question. First off, you're by far one of my favorite fitness profiles on Instagram. That's super nice. Thank you. Jeez. Thanks for everything you do. You're very welcome. Now, question. How to build muscle with limited equipment? Pull-up bar, resistance bands, dumbbells at home. First of all, you can join my group program. And if you have a pull-up bar, resistance bands, dumbbells, and an adjustable bench, you can do my group program. The truth is, it's not like how to build muscle with that stuff. You do the same thing you would always do, which is to train hard with good exercises, trying to progress over time. The less equipment you have, the better your programming needs to be, right? You don't have the luxury of a machine for every single function, right? You don't have a chest press machine and a chest supported rowing machine and a leg press and a leg extension and all this stuff. And so you need good programming, right? It's a little bit more complicated. It's not too complicated though. If I do it on a group program level, it's not too complicated, but your programming needs to be a little bit better just because you have a little bit less equipment. You're working with a little bit less stuff. But you can be, let me just be very blunt right now. You can get all 100%, I believe, of the health benefits of resistance training with the equipment that you just listed, provided that you have a bench. 100% of the benefits of resistance training. Can you get as jacked as possible with the equipment that you listed? No. But there's a big gap between the amount of training you'd have to do to be maximally healthy and the amount of training, the type of training, the equipment you would need, the loads you would need to get maximally jacked. There's a huge gap. So pull-up bar, resistance bands, dumbbells, and a bench, you can get, you can extract all the health benefits of exercise or of resistance training. I do think there will be a limit to how jacked you can get. I think you'll outgrow those adjustable dumbbells at some point. I think having more equipment is more fun, of course. It makes some movement patterns easier, but I think you can absolutely build a lot of muscle, be fit, strong, and healthy without a doubt with the equipment that you listed. Now, you asked again, how do you do that? Well, you do that with good programming and good effort. That is the formula. The right exercises in the right dose with the right effort. And I wish I could read you off a sample program, but I would say that my group program can be done with the equipment that you just listed. Even though we use a barbell, there are always swaps. Whenever we use a barbell, there's always a dumbbell swap. All right, last question. Is doing a spin class one time per week and getting a walk in and steps daily enough for health? So health is a spectrum. How much health, right? Optimal health? No. Optimal health? You would absolutely need at the very least 2 times per week resistance exercise. And I think if you're talking optimal health, we would need a little bit more cardio, definitely a couple days of lifting, and maybe even other things, because optimal health is a very specific, you know, the apex, the most health possible. If you are saying, hey, I'm doing spin class once a week and I walk enough, is that enough to be pretty healthy? I think if you're doing other things well, like eating a nutritious diet, a variety of plant foods, you know, I would say enough protein, but you're not lifting weights, so your protein requirements would be lower. I think the most egregious omission here is that you're not lifting weights. If you did this and you added 2 to 3 30-minute resistance exercise sessions per week, I think you would see a huge increase in health. If you ask me the same question, but you also add in 2 to 3 days of lifting, I'd say you're extracting a very, very high percentage of the health benefits of exercise. Maybe there's room for a little bit more cardio in there for just for heart health benefits. But if you added a couple days of resistance exercise, I think you'd be, you know, in business, so they say. All right, guys, thank you for asking questions. I'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.